Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koç is my name, Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim are my co-hosts. Gents, wonderful to see you both.
Good to be back.
Yep, always.
Well, what a week that was. Hard to know where to start, but let's go to the now notorious White House meeting last Friday between the US President Donald Trump, the Vice President J.D. Vance, and the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, which descended into a highly unusual public spectacle. It's made the rounds across mainstream media, social media. Everyone has been talking about it. But let's, in the spirit of putting things simply, go back to basics. Rodney, how on earth did it descend to the levels that we saw play out in the White House's Oval Office?
It was pretty dramatic. It wasn't something which was from the get-go, because there was a whole build-up of to and fro prior to the explosive point. We obviously had the rather juvenile question from a less than skilled journalist about President Zelensky's attire, him not wearing a suit. He was slightly irritated by that and didn't have the, I'm going to say the temperament at this point, but I can, and that's not a criticism. It's a, he didn't have the temperament just to raise an eyebrow and ignore the question, which is what should have happened in relation to that. And then, of course, Vance, who was smirking during that question, very different body language to Rubio sitting beside him, then started to goad Zelensky about not being grateful and not having thanked the Americans. And we went from there. And Trump, seeing the friction between his vice president and a visiting head of state, decided he would do what bullies always do, which is join the easy side. And there was finger pointing and jabbing, and it was deeply unpleasant, to be honest. The outcome, many Trump supporters are very happy with it. Many Trump critics are very unhappy with it. And we had the scramble within Europe to cobble something together over the weekend to show support for Zelensky without further alienating Donald Trump, with the UK offering to be a bridge between Europe and the US. And and now we have aid being paused for Ukraine, which on reflection, when you look at many of the things that are happening, it does feel like it's choreographed, and what happened on Friday was a pretext for many of the other decisions that are now going to be taken, whether it's Hegseth's downgrading of cyber offensive work by the Americans in relation to Russia, whether it's been the downgrading or stopping of investigations into Russian interference. And so it feels to me like it didn't just happen in the spontaneous way that that may seem to some people, because there clearly is a spark, but it felt like a goading, and it was going to continue until there was a reaction. Even when Zelensky arrived, Trump made a comment on his address sense, which is a bit of a clue. He's like the child at a party who can't avoid telling someone what their surprise is. And when you look at all these little points, it's a little bit like the way you build cases and evidence. If they all start to point in the same direction, there's probably some substance to it. So I do think it was deliberate on the part of the US administration, from the journalist question, from the Trump comment, from the J.D. Vance intervention, and Zelensky reacted to it. He could have not responded and ignored. But then again, earlier in the week, Macron got away with correcting Trump. And again, you may take the view that that was allowed to happen, not because they have a wonderful relationship, but because they were laying the ground for what was going to happen on Friday. Ozan, are you going to say that it just happened and it was spontaneous? Or are you taking the view that it was a little bit more cunning and planning in this one?
I'm not sure the particular instance or the particular course of events was all that well choreographed, if it was. But I think it that to me is the less important part. I think the more important part is there was certainly a series of events that were leading up to that, and whether it was choreographed or not, it shocked me, but it didn't surprise me because I think what's very clear here is that Donald Trump has realized, and maybe not just realized, but has always known that Putin is a tough sell. When you side with Putin, it's a tough sell domestically and it's a tough sell internationally. And, you know, at the end of the day, he has sided with Putin, and we will get to in a minute why we think that's happening, but I think more just to paint a picture of, I think, what happened on Friday and, you know, how these things came about. But he has sided with Putin and against his allies in some ways. He has resorted to calling Zelensky a dictator. He has resorted to saying that it was effectively Zelensky's fault that Ukraine got invaded. All of these just bizarre comments. And a lot of that has been to try and fire up some support for him. He knows that there is a percentage of the US population that will effectively believe anything that he says or he truths. So he was trying to get a bit of momentum happening. And that is really to try and politically sell his decision to side with Putin. And I think this was kind of another one of those tactics, because let's face it, I think he certainly got a win on that day because I think it really rallied up his base. You know, the minute it happened or a few minutes later, X was full of all sorts of offensive kind of statements towards Zelensky. You know, you are ungrateful, what so and so, get out of our country, how dare you come here, etc. So he was able to kind of get some of that America first feeling and spirit happening. So I think that was a win for him. I think it was a win for Zelensky as well. It's probably not a very popular view, but I think Zelensky was able to show his domestic audience that he's standing up. He's able to show Europe that he's not going to bow down to it. So if Europe was struggling to come up with some conviction itself, he is a safe bet. Not a safe bet, but he's solid. And most importantly, I think most of us don't realize that Zelensky's number one audience in a lot of this is Putin. I think, you know, it's the mind games that those two are probably playing through the media. So at the end of the day, I mean, there are all sorts of communications, body language experts, all sorts of people talking about how, you know, Zelensky handled it wrongly, particularly on LinkedIn. And really, at the end of the day, how else could he have handled it? Like, what do you expect a guy who has come to the Oval Office? He's been at war for 3 years. He looks like he hasn't slept for about, you know, 3 years. He's lost millions of people, and he's getting a lecture about how he doesn't want peace. I mean, this is just absurd. I can't even believe we're having this conversation. How can you tell a bunch of people who have been invaded, who have lost a generation of young people, who have lost 5 million people out of their country, have lost so much, all for Russia's obscure ambitions and one man's Putin's obscure ambitions? How can you tell these people that they don't want peace? I mean, he did exactly what I would have expected him to do. He looked good for his own audience, and at the end of the day, I look at it as everyone got what they need out of it. And it was horrific to watch. It was shocking. But at the end of the day, this is a negotiation. This is how Trump plays. And I don't think it set Zelensky back. I don't think it you know, set Trump back. I think, you know, if we're going to talk about football terms, it was a very solid nil-nil draw.
But that's the point, that you don't burn a relationship that doesn't exist anymore, so it doesn't matter.
Absolutely.
So therefore, Zelensky could do what he pleased. And I agree with you with all this over analytics in terms of body language and so on, and what may or may not have been properly adjudged to have been respectful or not. But I do think that he could have been much more clinical in how he responded to factual points. And I know Macron did the whole touchy-touchy, feely-feely thing with Trump when he was sort of correcting him. But maybe Zelensky didn't have to correct him on so many points, and maybe could have done it in a more cold fashion than seem to sort of warm up everyone else and continue the disagreement. But ultimately, there was no deal on minerals. Whether there's actually any substance to that is a separate point. And whether either party wanted a deal on minerals, because the perceptions of the deal seem to be very different. One side saying it's for future military support and security guarantees, with the other side taking the view that it was a payment for historic support without any future ongoing support or security guarantees. It does feel to me that Zelensky, Trump, irrespective of Trump's favour towards Putin, and we may, as you said, come on to talk about why is he doing it. I don't think he's some great strategist, Ozan, I'm afraid. I don't think this is some great effort to prise Russia away from its relationship with China and so on. I think what we're really seeing is a petulant man who's president of America, who doesn't like Zelensky because of his role in the previous impeachment of Trump. And therefore, he'll never be able to form a relationship with him. And I know that people will say, well, look, he's looked past what Vance said about him. He's looked past what maybe even RFK criticized him in the past. Who knows? Quite difficult to know. So many people criticizing him and then turning to become sycophants. But Zelensky certainly hasn't done that, and isn't prepared to compromise on very clear principles. And that doesn't sit well with Donald Trump. So there's certainly personal animosity that underlies some of this, as well as an absolute disinterest from the likes of Vance and other people in the administration in having any role in Ukraine, spending any American money there. They don't see America as a country that needs to promote democratic values around the world anymore and defend democratic nations. They're very happy to see spheres of influence develop that really is neither here nor there, and which is why they're trying to use tariffs to produce their own vassal states and their own borders that are compliant and enact policy that's in line with their domestic interests or perceived domestic interests, or possibly more accurately, interests of the administration. So no strategic thing, I'm afraid, from my perspective about what great play Donald Trump might be making.
What about the strategy of Zelensky here? Because there is a school of thought that he needs the US. He needs the US from a monetary perspective to continue to support the resistance in Ukraine to the aggression by Russia and by Putin. Did he come to the US and not deal with it in the way that he should have? Because if you think about him getting a little bit annoyed about the suit comment, right, which is ironic given that Elon Musk has now been in the Oval Office a couple of times with, you know, wearing a baseball hat and a T-shirt. So obviously, you know, other people are allowed in the Oval Office without a suit, and that's not disrespectful to the highest office in the land in the US. But, I mean, you got to give Zelensky credit for the PR machine that he has built. You know, he has done an extraordinary amount of interviews, ranging from Letterman to other places, you know, from like underground venues and you know, you hear the sort of sirens going off and whatnot. There's no question that his country is at war and has been invaded by Russia. I think that, you know, is sort of that's for the history books. But I mean, Zelensky's PR machine has been incredible. It's why he dresses the way he dresses. He could have absolutely worn a suit. I mean, if he can fly to the US, he can wear a suit to the Oval Office, right? That he can do. He chooses not to. And so for someone who is very strategic and very clever about the image he portrays and the way he speaks to foreign leaders and to foreign nations, of which he relies upon to continue to defend his country, did he stuff this one up?
That's the question on what the calculation is, right? If the calculation is that it's not a relationship that's going to produce further support going forward, no matter what happens, well, then he didn't stuff it up because he's done well domestically. He's played well in Europe by his defiance. And as Suzanne rightly points out, he sent a message to the Kremlin that they're not going to just give in because America's taken a dim view of whatever it happens to be, or the Trump administration and so on. Within that calculation is that they can continue to fight for another period of time with the resources that they have, which has to be part of the calculation, as well as when European support might become more significant in terms of hard military support rather than just financial support, and capacity within Europe to produce more shells or drones or whatever it happens to be. Those will all be things which would be calculated in a decision to stand up to Trump, knowing that the relationship might be burned on the basis that it was never going to produce future significant support anyway, because the Americans were minded to walk away from it. And then sitting within that whole thing is what is the substance of this rare earth, as Donald Trump kept saying, rare earth, as if it's something for a soil specialist. What, you know, what really is the value of metals that are within Ukraine unable to be mined? Because there's two versions of this, that actually it's not that substantial in terms of global resource, and whilst it would give access to an additional resource, it's small, not large percentages. So the Ukrainians will know what they thought was likely to be the outcome of that meeting. It may well be that they took the view they didn't want to be bounced into this deal and were happy to walk away and saw this and see this as part of a longer negotiation to get greater advantage, because the Americans were pitching it that he just had to come up and sign, come over and sign an agreement, irrespective of how fair, balanced, future-proofed, or whatever it was. There was one sit-down that Zelensky did do with journalists in the UK over the weekend, where he cited being on a train for 11 hours and then a flight or something in order to go to this Washington meeting, which was a slight hint that he may have been tired and irritable, but nobody's really gone much further with that as some sort of excuse for why the meeting went south in the way it did. So, yeah, it's a calculation, and it's not clear who was happy to burn that meeting or whether both were ultimately, and maybe not in the way that was as catastrophic as it turned out to be, because I don't think anyone planned for that level of public animosity.
Look, I mean, I have a different view. I think in terms of, I don't understand these people told me, you've got to listen to the whole thing so you can get the full content. I listened to it. First 35 minutes were like watching paint grow, dry. It was just boring, etc. Something that Zelensky said. And again, Zelensky's English isn't as good as Vance's. One could argue it's probably better than Trump's, but empty kind of thoughts and empty, just verbal diarrhea for most of it. And then he responded to J.D. Vance, making a point about the fact that, look, you know, all your people have died. No shit, Sherlock. You know, there's a lot of suffering. Yeah, again, no shit, Sherlock. You need to start diplomacy. And then that's when he actually said, well, outlined facts, which are that you can't trust Putin. He doesn't stick to agreements, treaties, ceasefires, etc. And you know, effectively, what he was alluding at was, you have a gun to my head. What type of diplomacy are we talking about? I mean, a week before that, Trump was running around saying that, that Ukraine won't be at the negotiating table. So you can imagine he was just trying to point out. Maybe he did it a bit aggressively. Again, I'm not an expert on body language. We can maybe ask the thousands of people who apparently are experts on body language. But who cares? This is not the point. The point is he pointed out a few things, and whether this episode happened on this day or the next meeting, it was bound to happen. So I don't think Zelensky screwed anything up. I think he was just making a point, and then Trump jumped in with a whole bunch of things like, "Well, you don't know what we're going to feel. We're going to feel beautiful things." Again, saying just stuff that makes no sense, and then they were just trying to talk over each other. It was, as I said, horrific to watch. You would expect to behave like adults, but I don't think Zelensky did anything wrong. Like, I think this to me, if you ask me, is just a rubbish takeaway from all of this. I think it needs to be looked in the context of, what has Zelensky got to lose? Not much. What did he do? What did he get out of this? Well, except for people in the US, most of the world he actually rallied behind him. So again, I don't think that's a massive loss. What did Trump do? All those people who disliked Trump's position on this, you know, disliked it even more. And then he managed to rally some of his troops. I don't think this has any real kind of significance from beyond that. Now, one thing on Zelensky, though, you're absolutely right, Adam. I think he's got an amazing machine. And one of the things that I would actually give some credibility to, an argument that I saw, was, you know, he's not used to getting a reception like that. He's been flying around the world for the last 3 years and being hailed a hero. This is the first time, effectively, that he was reprimanded or called into the principal's office to have to justify his actions in some way. And that's what it looked like. So naturally, he might have been a bit defensive and probably a little bit out of practice in terms of how to deal with it. But again, to me, this is all just irrelevant. I mean, it's a sideshow. The real show here is there is a negotiation going on, and neither side won or lost all that much from this. They managed to shore up the support that they need. And now it's, you know, let's look at what happens now. It's up to the EU. The EU have to step up and start to give some sort of security guarantees, and they've started doing that.
Indeed, and what has been described by UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer as European unity at an extremely high level, not seen for a long time. He is leading the charge here, particularly with his narrative, talking about the coalition of the willing to support Ukraine against Putin and against Russia. He said that the UK is prepared to put boots on the ground, planes in the air, etc., and that the EU will, I guess, stand behind Ukraine. What happens now, Rodney? Is peace possible without the US?
Well, I mean, reality is going to have to bite on that. In that, can they persuade the US to play a role in any settlement? But what has happened is, from this being a discussion between America and Russia in Saudi Arabia, you now have America, you now have Europe and Ukraine negotiating with America to create a shared outcome, shared position, in order to make whatever proposition to Russia. So I think Keir Starmer has had a pretty much a great weekend. He got a great reception in Parliament yesterday from all sides of the House. But what there isn't within Europe is the military capacity and depth in the short term to do many of the things that they would probably like to do by way of security guarantees, which is why they continually come back to the point that they need America to underwrite or offer some sort of security backstop for whatever the agreement happens to be. And even Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, who's now the British ambassador to the US, in his interview on ABC over the weekend, was playing very much a pro-Trump administration position, that there was a slight bit of friction when the defense secretary said it wasn't government policy in the UK. So a lot of the commentary and the political commentators are being briefed that the situation's very fluid, which I think is a fair assessment on any perspective of what's going on. And I think that, you know, people are reacting still to what's being said every few hours. But, you know, Europe wants to do a certain job. They can't do it on their own at the moment. And this isn't just about finance, it's about military capacity. And they also want to bring the US back closer to the European and the Ukrainian position. Now, whether that's possible with the Trump administration is something that remains to be seen. I think the true assessment of this entire episode from the week before Friday, what happened on Friday, what's happened since, the history won't be written over these couple of weeks. It'll be something which will be written much further down the line when much more information about what was going on the inside starts to leak out, and we're not at that position yet. But Europe is trying, whether it can actually do it, something else.
Look, I think this has been an amazing weekend, as you said, for Keir Starmer, and it may well have rehabilitated his leadership after a pretty lackluster start to his reign. So I think from that point of view, it's good someone stepping up. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, we don't know what's going on in the background, and typically not many people do. So, you know, all we have is really what we see, a lot of the theatre that we saw in the Oval Office, etc. But I would be very surprised if Europe didn't include the US. I don't think this is possible without the US. You know, and again, it's not got to do with the money, because despite what President Trump claims, you know, in terms of 350 billion spent, etc., when you look at the actual data, Europe has provided significant military support, sorry, aid, humanitarian aid. Europe is now home to millions of Ukrainians who have been able to get asylum there. So Europe is able to help out. It's just the problem is, as Rodney said, Europe has spent the last 50, 60 years, certainly since the World War II, dearming itself and not focused on rearming. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? We can spend hours probably discussing that. However, they've felt the need not to, because the US has run, you know, the biggest defense budget, three or four times the next biggest defense budget for the last 20, 30 years. So, and they've had a pretty ironclad agreement to or a tri an alliance. And, you know, Trump's trying to shake that up. Now, if I was an American, I might see some value in that. And I might say, okay, that's fair. Like, why should we have to protect Europeans from what they're claiming to be an existential threat from Putin? However, that's not how these things work. There's a very good reason for why Europe went through this whole period of not arming, you know, and many people who are saying these things, I don't think fully appreciate history, because, you know, until the last 60, 70 years, you know, pretty much every world war, well, every world war was there, but pretty much every country in Europe was warring with each other for the last 1,000 years. So, you know, peace in Europe is not something that's been a feature for a very long time. So, you know, there's some very historic reasons for it. And, you know, successive presidents have tried to make Europe start to defend, spend more on defense to protect itself, and they've been unsuccessful. So maybe this is a silver lining. Maybe this is a shock that the Europeans needed, but it looks like they're taking it seriously this time, because at the end of the day, they have no choice. I mean, I don't think Trump is lying when he says he's, you know, he's going to cut aid. He's expecting Europe to step up, etc. I think he's fully serious about that. And again, Trump doesn't have anything to lose. He doesn't, you know, he's not allowed to serve another term in the current constitutional framework. So, you know, he's all about you know, pushing his own agenda, and that involves Europe paying its way.
Yeah, I mean, he has been the most successful U.S. president of getting Europe to spend more on defense, or to commit to spend more on defense, but the others didn't do so. That's surprising, burning every diplomatic positive relationship with the European countries, because the European relationship in terms of European leaders with Trump now is that they go and pay insincere homage to his greatness on the basis that they need to. But at some point when they don't need to, that's going to change. But the policy in Europe of letting America shoulder everything in defense was probably fine for 75 of the last 79 years. But maybe in the last couple of years, a rethink could have happened earlier, but it's certainly happening now.
Well, if it's one thing Trump's been consistent about, it is looking at the expenditure of the US. And he's always said that he's had a problem with the level of aid that has been provided to Ukraine, more than $120 billion since Russia invaded 3 years ago, including around $67 billion in military aid, which of course has now been paused. This also is consistent with Doge and what Doge is looking at, and the cuts to the spending, particularly around aid to developing countries, etc. Tariffs now come into effect, of course, against three countries, Canada, Mexico, and China. So there's a bit of economic tension there, and well, the budget is fragile as ever. Ozan, take us through the economics of where Trump and the Trump administration is sitting at, and sort of where it's likely to go in the next little while.
It's very difficult to tell, because at the end of the day, I think, there is an inherent tension in what the Trump administration is trying to do. It's trying to build, it's highlighted the fiscal deficit as one of its major kind of areas to focus on. And they're not wrong there. I mean, when you're paying more in interest payments on your loan than what is, effectively your budget for main items like education, health, and defense, etc. When you're doing that, there's something wrong. So they've focused on that. However, the tensions come in, because what they're also trying to do is bring in an extension, and they want to make permanent the tax cuts to that he put in place in the first term. In the first term, I believe they cost about $2.53 trillion. And they were unfunded, which in simple terms means there was nothing to offset them in terms of savings, etc. So, again, it looks like there's not much, of a plan, whilst Doge is running around with chainsaws trying to cut the budget. It's a hell of a lot of budget to cut if you want to bring in and make permanent tax cuts that are, this time, I think, going to cost around $4 billion. Don't quote me on that figure. So, there's a big tension there in terms of on the fiscal side. On the tariff side, this is something that I think we may have discussed on the podcast, but certainly something that's been bothering me, is that you have, even if you don't implement tariffs, which he has today implemented them, the threat of tariffs is a very, very negative thing for investment and business sentiment. So I think what you're going to see, and you're already seeing it, I'm experiencing it in my own professional life and my conversations with senior business people, etc., is real contraction in investment. Many people, even if you're not directly impacted by the tariffs, you're going to sit back, because there is now a negative economic sentiment, whether it's on the consumer side or the business side, it's starting to creep in into the economy, and this is really, really bad, and it's effectively something that is being there's some data to prove. There's been a couple of data sets that have come out in terms of projected GDP growth going down significantly. The stock market You always have to look at investors. The stock market's like a washing machine. It's up and down, whirling around, etc. It's not doing well. So I think economically speaking, there is a lot of confusion about what the kind of the signs are that and the message that the Trump administration is trying to send. I'm not sure they know, because I think they're in a hurry to do a whole bunch of things, and they're really going to struggle, mainly because in about, I think it's during March, they have to pass a temporary debt ceiling increase. Effectively to buy themselves some time until they can put together a budget that they can get through the Congress and the Senate. And that budget is going to be a very, very difficult budget to put together. I mean, it's particularly, as I said, you're promising to cut things. You're promising to give a whole bunch of things away in tax breaks. These are not, the maths just doesn't add up. And I'm not great at maths, but even I can see that this is going to be very difficult. So it's confusion. And I think that's now starting to translate to a serious kind of reduction in sentiment and people starting to have very pessimistic views about the future of the economy.
Well, looking back to Europe quickly now, and Germans voted in the biggest turnout in its elections for more than 40 years, 82.5% voter turnout, which basically means more than 4 in 5 of every Germany's voters turned out. To an interesting result, Rodney, take us through that quickly.
Yeah, so, I mean, this isn't so different from where the polling was at in advance of the election. Though, you may say that AfD did slightly better, but the CDU have won the election with 28.5%. AfD come in, which is a far-right party, at 20.8%. And the SPD, who were the incumbent government under Olaf Scholz, had about 16% of the voters, 16.8%, and that's their worst performance since 1887, which is slightly significant if you are someone who follows that political party. The issue now will be what type of coalition is formed and how quickly. Friedrich Merz will be the chancellor. The options will not include the AfD, so therefore there will be the potential for a grand coalition between the CDU and the SPD, the outgoing government, which is possible because as Scholz will stand down, Pistorius, who's the current defence minister, is still the most popular politician in Germany. So there's a chance for rescuing the perception that there hasn't been change in that in the outgoing government, having lost the election and so on. So the Grand Coalition is an option. There's also an option for what they call the Black-Green Coalition, which is with the CDU and the Greens, or my favourite one, which is the Kenyan Coalition, presumably because it involves Black, Green and Red, which would be the Grand Coalition plus the Greens. The important thing for Europe, given the instability or the fluid situation, in terms of the relationship with the US, is that we get the German coalition agreement sorted out quickly, a stable Germany, and not the 6 months or whatever it took Austria to form their coalition, which of course is now in place, and again involving the Liberals, the People's Party and the Social Democrats, so also excluding the far right. So we need it to happen a lot quicker than Austria, but I expect a similar outcome. And even at the Lancaster House talks in London at the weekend, you could see that Scholz was sitting very far down the table, and that that indicates his imminent departure from the scene. So yeah, Merz will be in, Pistorius potentially still in defence in the coalition, and stable government for Germany. I mean, they have to deal with obvious economic challenges, they're going to have to deal with immigration, they're big issues to deal with, but they now have a period of time to provide stable government and get on with addressing the domestic issues as well as the big foreign policy issue that we've discussed.
Well, no shortage of things to talk about. It's the gift that keeps on giving here on Put Simply every single week. Rodney and Ozan, thank you so much for your time. Good seeing you this week. See you again next.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroku Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.